Welcome to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in today for Marty Moscawain.
All stations on June Accord, we have the tone for burn cutoff on Delta B. Gratis omum, Juno. Welcome to Jupiter.
And that was the moment of confirmation last night at Mission Control at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena. The spacecraft Juno had successfully managed to slip into Jupiter's orbit. No easy feat. Juno had just one chance to thread the needle and manage precise and precisely timed maneuvers to enter Jupiter's orbit or risk circling around the sun, which would have been a huge failure. So Juno's journey is our focus this hour. And here to start us off is Randy Gladstone, program director for the Southwest Research Institute and instrument lead for Juno's ultraviolet spectrograph. Randy, welcome.
Thank you. It's nice to be here on after a successful orbit insertion.
Yeah, it could have gone either way last night, so it is nice to have a celebratory show this morning. Juno was attempting what's called the orbital insertion. What was going through your mind?
I was pretty confident. You know, these engineers are really, really good. So, it's a little nerve-wracking, but I thought these guys would pull it off. So I was sort of enjoying it, but sort of just waiting for the all clear sort of.
What exactly has to happen during the orbital insertion? The thrusters
Juno is going really fast relative to Jupiter and about 60 kilometers per second. So, a couple hundred thousand miles an hour or something. So it has to really slam on the brakes to get into orbit around Jupiter. So it's a crucial time. There's a crucial time where it has to fire its engine for like half an hour. And it did that. It did it to what its plan was, to the nearest second, I'm told. So, they really nailed it, basically.
It's amazing when you think that Juno has been traveling toward Jupiter for 5 years, and it's been timed to the second to have this happen on the evening of July 4th.
Yeah, it's awesome what they can do with, navigating these spacecraft nowadays. It's beyond belief for me. I'm just a scientist. I just, use it to study Jupiter, but it still blows me away that they can do stuff like this.
So, Randy, set the table for us. Describe Juno's mission.
Okay, well, Juno is, we've gone to Jupiter many times now, so, you'd think we'd know all about it, but every time we go, we learn something new. And the last couple of times, we realized we really don't know how Jupiter formed. And Jupiter's the biggest planet in our solar system. So we really want to learn about gas giants and Jupiter-like planets in general, because they're very important in other solar systems, it seems. So Juno's meant to study the inside of Jupiter, which will tell us how it formed, and other things about it that we don't know, like how its magnetic field is generated, which is also deep inside Jupiter. So we go very close to Jupiter, and that lets us build up maps of the gravity field and the magnetic field to understand how they're generated inside and how the mass is spread out inside Jupiter to tell if there's a core or not, which will tell us how it formed. We're also trying to figure out how much oxygen is there, because the last time we measured it, we think we got it wrong, because the Galileo probe that went in probably went in a very special region, like a desert on Jupiter, and measured a low amount of oxygen. So we're hoping that we'll measure those things, and that'll tell us a lot more about the history of Jupiter.
So, again, you are principal investigator of Juno's ultraviolet imaging spectrograph, one of the instruments on board. What does this do?
Okay, well, one more thing that we're a goal of the mission is to study the polar magnetosphere. So magnetosphere is like the region of space carved out of the solar wind by Jupiter's magnetic field. And it's really big at Jupiter. It's like, 100 times bigger than Earth's. And Jupiter's auroras are like 1,000 times more powerful than the ones on Earth. And I really like auroras. I study them at Earth and stuff. So studying them at Jupiter is fun, because there's a lot to them. And we have a very limited view from Earth, very good view from a Hubble Space Telescope imaging, but it's sort of oblique. We only see the auroras sort of sideways on. Whereas with Juno, we'll get to see them right over top of them. We'll fly through the region where the particles are accelerated. We'll learn a whole lot more about Jupiter's auroras on this mission, and that's the part I'm excited about.
There's a Juno cam on board, right?
Yeah, there's a camera that the public can actually, you know, suggest places to take pictures of, and if people agree that those are good ideas, it's sort of a democratic vote on where to look, and the people that win each orbit will get a few pictures of different places on Jupiter. And we're also hoping to look at the polar regions with this. This camera will do a lot of science, too. It's not just, you know, to get ooh and ah pictures. It'll get great science over the poles and maybe lightning and auroras as well.
Well, that said, even as JunoCam might be taking requests, Juno still can't get too close to Jupiter. You said that Juno will get close to Jupiter, but it can't go below the cloud banks, right? What happens if Juno does that?
That would be tough because we're going to, anytime we get really close to Jupiter, it means we're going really, really fast. So if you go too deep, it'd be like, you know, running through a bunch of bullets going really fast. Bad idea. So we go high enough that there's not so much atmosphere. We go about 5,000 kilometers above the cloud top, then the air is thin enough there that we won't, you know, run into any trouble with the spacecraft. But it's close enough that we get this really detailed view of the magnetic field and gravity field and the aurora. We're going to have a great view of the aurora. But that happens once we get it. Well, so far we're just in this capture orbit. So there's sort of a big orbit that we do two loops around Jupiter, and then we fire the rockets again, sort of like we did during last night. And then we go into a shorter orbit that's only 14 days, and that's the main science mission that lasts about a year and a quarter. So every 2 weeks, we're going to go in real close, real fast, and make a high-resolution look at Jupiter's clouds and auroras and stuff.
I'm sure you'll get some spectacular pictures. So speaking of the auroras, are they similar to our northern lights?
They're very similar, but there's a lot of differences, too. There's an oval like we have on Earth, but Earth's oval is sort of always mostly aligned with the sun, whereas Jupiter's ovals rotate with the planet, and Jupiter rotates like in 10 hours, so it's like 2.5 times faster than Earth's day. But Jupiter also has these Galilean satellites inside its magnetosphere. Earth's moon is sort of mostly outside Earth's magnetosphere, and the Galilean satellites, at least Io, is volcanic and dumps all this sulfur and oxygen into the magnetosphere of Jupiter. Anyway, it ends up that the Galilean satellites all have their separate sort of connection to Jupiter's aurora, and they produce bright spots that move around. And there's also these flares that go off inside the ovals at each end. You know, we have the aurora oval in the north and in the south. So there's lots of similarities and lots of differences, too.
You spoke about...
We're looking forward to seeing, you know, making sense of it all.
Yeah, Randy, you referenced Juno's air a little bit ago. How does that compare to the air on Earth? What is it comprised of?
On Jupiter? Yeah, Jupiter's sort of just like a mini sun. It's mostly hydrogen and helium, so there's not much of those things on Earth, but people have heard of them, I'm sure. They're very light gases, and it's got some other gases there like carbon and nitrogen and oxygen that are at smaller amounts. Like there's methane and water and ammonia on Jupiter, the next most common elements. But it's basically like a mini sun. If Jupiter were like 100 times bigger, it would have turned on like our sun did.
And yet it's so far out, it's so far flung out that the temperatures are extraordinarily cold. And I guess you wouldn't be thinking about anything that would resemble the building blocks for life, or would you?
Most people don't think about Jupiter as being likely place for life. But if your listeners remember Carl Sagan, he once wrote a scientific paper about the possibility of organisms that float around in Jupiter's atmosphere, sinkers and floaters it was on, that, you know, it, like big jellyfish that sort of just, you know, waft along on the breeze on near Jupiter's clouds. And it's possible. I don't think many people think it's likely, though.
Mm-hmm.
But it is, you know, it has all the materials there if it needed it. There's just no solid surface on Jupiter, so it'd be like swimming your entire life.
So Juno is going to be orbiting Jupiter for, what, close to 2 years?
Close to that. We end in, we're supposed to end in February of 2018, I believe, after about 36 orbits or something like that. So we'll get a very good look at it. Every orbit's going to be different. It's like a flyby every 2 weeks for that time. It's going to be fun.
And she's entirely solar powered?
Yes, yeah, it's giant solar arrays in order to generate the power needed. Usually at Jupiter and further out, you use nuclear power, a radioisotope generated power, plutonium, basically. Like on New Horizons last year, when it went to Pluto, there's no way it can use solar power out there, and it used plutonium to generate its electricity. Normally that's done at Jupiter too, but Juno's, you know, breaking new ground using higher efficiency solar arrays and things to get the power it needs from the sun, even that far out from the sun.
So at the end of the mission, Randy, what happens to Juno?
Well, you know, we haven't talked about it, but Jupiter's radiation environment is really intense. We sort of dive through a hole in the radiation when we go in close, so we avoid most of it, but because of Jupiter's gravity, our orbit gets torqued around. It changes. Each orbit is a little bit different, and it gets worse and worse as far as radiation goes. So we think that radiation is going to eventually kill the instruments, and that's why the mission is only a year and a quarter. Otherwise, we'd stay there for much longer. So eventually, we'll fire our rockets to just deorbit into Jupiter, because we don't want to risk the chance that Juno crashes into Europa or one of the other moons where people think there's a chance there might be life. So they really go out of their way to protect Europa from contamination.
Interesting. Well, we'll be talking about the radiation and much more as the show continues. But in the meantime, Juno is up. Juno is operating. NASA is receiving information. How long does it take Juno to transmit to Earth?
The one-way light time is about 45 minutes, I believe. So if you wanted to send up a command and hear back what the result was, you'd have to wait an hour and a half in order to know if it worked or not. So a lot of what Juno does is pre-planned so that they don't have to, worry about that time. But if something goes wrong, then they'll have to do it more carefully. But, it's quite a ways away.
All right, we're coming up on a break, but we're going to be right back in just a moment with more on the Juno mission to Jupiter. We're joined by Randy Gladstone for a few more minutes. He is program director with the Southwest Research Institute. And joining us coming right up is Eric Jensen, professor of astronomy at Swarthmore College. Also, we should be joined by Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. If you'd like to jump into the conversation, here's the number, 888-477-9499. More just ahead. Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moscowane. Last night, the space probe Juno successfully managed to move into Jupiter's orbit. It was a make or break situation that doubtless had scientists across the country biting their fingernails. The orbital insertion, however, was a success, and now we talk about what Juno will give to us. Here for the rest of the hour is Eric Jensen, professor of astronomy in the physics and astronomy department at Swarthmore College. Welcome to Radio Times, Eric.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
And also with us for a little bit more, Randy Gladstone, program director with the Southwest Research Institute and instrument lead for the ultraviolet imaging spectrograph on Juno. So first to you, Eric, where were you last night when Juno was attempting the orbital insertion, and what was going through your mind as this was happening?
I was actually in bed. At about 11 o'clock, I looked at it and I thought, well, it's still an hour to go till it's going to happen, and I really kind of want to stay up and see what's going to happen, but I don't know. Whatever's going to happen is going to happen either way, and I thought, you know, like Randy said, I have a lot of confidence in the amazing engineers at NASA. So I just went to bed and slept. But I will first thing I did when I got up this morning, though, was check to see what happened. And it was great to see that it went successfully.
Yeah, it was. It was one of those situations where it could have gone either way, even though you have a lot of obviously very talented people behind the project. So, Eric, at the end of this mission, which will cost, by the time it's all wrapped up, over $1 billion, what do you want to see brought back from what Juno is collecting? What do you want us to have from Juno?
Yeah, so I think this is a great opportunity to make a connection between our own solar system. Obviously, we're going to learn a lot about Jupiter very specifically. It seems a little weird to think of Jupiter as close by when it's hundreds of millions of miles away. But compared to what I study most of the time, which is planets around other stars, Jupiter is really quite close. And so I think it'll be great to be able to see what we can learn specifically about Jupiter, but also to see whether we can generalize some of that to help us learn a little bit about how planets form in general, how planets might form around other stars besides our sun.
Juno faced some obstacles getting to Jupiter, to put it mildly, for instance, and we'll bring you back into the conversation here, Randy, it had to get through the magnetosphere. We were talking about that a little bit earlier of Jupiter. It started to get into the magnetosphere, I think, in mid-June. And that could have taken Juno out. Correct, Randy?
Well, we have been in Jupiter's magnetosphere before with other spacecraft. But, that radiation environment we were talking about is pretty intense. It's possible they could have had some anomaly there. But, the main part is closer to Jupiter when we were right at that engine firing time that we were worried about.
Okay. Well, just we have some pretty cool audio, I think, anyway, from NASA. Posted audio of what's known as the bow shock, which is the point at which Juno actually entered the magnetosphere. So let's take a listen. So when you hear that, I guess that bit of a boom there, what are we hearing, Eric? Or Randy?
Oh, sorry.
I'll let Randy take it.
Okay. Well, this is a called the waves instrument that picked up that sound. It wasn't really sound. They're listening to electromagnetic waves that are generated by charged particles in the solar wind, and that's that high pitched sort of sound that's sort of steady. And then it drops in tone quite a bit, and that's where it crosses the bow shock. And the bow shock is still solar wind, but it's just solar wind that's been influenced, that's felt Jupiter's presence, and it's got heated up, and so it drops in tone quite a bit there. There's also a sound of it entering the magnetopause of Jupiter, too, and it sounds pretty ominous when you play it this way. So it makes Jupiter sound even more powerful.
And the solar wind blows at about 1,000,000 miles an hour?
That sounds about right. I usually think in metric, so it's around 400 kilometers a second.
Hmm.
So really fast. It's going by Jupiter all the time. And one of the things we're looking to find out on Jupiter's auroras is how much that solar wind influences Jupiter's auroras. We know it influences Earth's auroras a lot, but we don't know really, or at least there's a lot of lively debate about how much it influences Jupiter's auroras.
Eric Jensen, how is Jupiter outfitted to protect it, Juno, I should say, outfitted to protect itself against things like the magnetosphere and the radiation, the intense radiation, so it can last the length of time it needs to exist to do its job?
Right. So as Randy said, it's we may think of space as being pretty empty, but it's a pretty harsh environment out there with these very high energy particles that are streaming from the sun and accelerated by that magnetic field. My understanding is that the main scientific instruments in Juno are sealed inside a heavy titanium vault. So it's almost like a big bank vault that was built around the sensitive parts of the electronics to help protect it from this harsh radiation environment so that it can continue to function and study this harsh environment but still be able to send its data back to Earth.
And it apparently is working so far.
Seems to be working well.
Okay. There's a theory that Jupiter once pushed some other planets out of the solar system, and scientists are hoping that Juno can shed some light. Randy Gladstone?
Well, now you're getting into areas I don't know that much about. But,
sorry.
Recently it's gotten a lot more exciting. We used to think the planets just formed where they are now and nothing else happened much in the solar system. But people think now that Jupiter's moved around a lot since it was formed. Might have even come in as far as Earth's orbit at one point. And, definitely pushed things around, threw a lot of small things out or in, and it eventually settled down to where it is now, but had a huge influence on how the other planets formed and what happened to them, too.
All right. Randy Gladstone, I'd like to thank you so much for joining us on Radio Times.
Thank you very much, Mary. It was great to talk to you.
Randy is an instrument lead on the Juno mission and program director at the Southwest Research Institute. And we also welcome Derek Pitts, chief astronomer and director of the Fells Planetarium at the Franklin Institute. Thanks for joining us, Derek.
Thanks for
How
having
are
me
you?
Here. I'm
so
fine. I'm good.
I'll ask you the question I've asked everybody else. What was going through your mind when Juno made it last night, actually achieved the orbital insertion?
I was very much interested to find out that it did actually achieve the orbital insertion. You know, there's always a level of concern and trepidation, especially considering that Jupiter is such an intense place for a spacecraft to be. You know, and I'm sure you've spoken about the magnetic fields and the radiation fields and things like that, and also the very close passage above the cloud tops of Jupiter. With such a mission, this particular critical stage is always the first point or the last point of the major amount of concern of if everything's going to go well. If it misses this turnoff, then off into space, $1.1 billion goes without collecting all the information that was intended to be collected. But one of the things that I think that we should be able to take great pride in is that the engineers who build these spacecraft and design the trajectories and all those things really know what they're doing. And they clearly understand what it's going to take and have worked out all the contingency plans. And for the most part, they're incredibly successful at what they do. So that showed up last night, too.
We were saying that after nearly 2 billion miles and 5 years, it was timed down to almost to the second. So
yeah, my driving trips across country aren't that successful.
you and the rest of us, Derek. So, again, there's a lot of investment in money and time at stake here. Give us a sense of what goes into the production of such a mission from start to finish. Somebody thinks, okay, let's do this, and then how long does it take to get something like this actually launched? Eric Jensen?
Decades. I don't know for this specific mission, but there's a very detailed process from mission concept to funding for exploratory studies to starting to actually spec out the instruments to building a team to building the spacecraft and getting it launched. And NASA has certainly pushed to speed up that process in recent decades, but you don't want to speed it up too much. You want to take you want to do it as fast as possible, but not faster. And so you want to make sure everything is planned carefully, make sure you have tested everything very well, and but people really put big chunks of their careers into making these things successful, and I'm sure Randy and a bunch of other people on the team are starting to see those many years of hard work pay off as we're going to start to get the results from the mission over the next year or so.
How big is Juno? Give us a sense of the size.
Juno is about the size of a basketball court, maybe two basketball courts if you stack them, I suppose. What is it, 60 feet across the solar panel booms?
Right, and a big chunk of that is the solar panels. As Randy was saying, when you're five times as far from the sun as Earth is, you only get about 1/25th of the sunlight, and so you need big solar panels to try to power the spacecraft.
Mm. Yeah.
And what does it take to get images and information from Jupiter to Earth? What do those have to travel through? It's 45 minutes, right, you said, about to get here. So really, it's just empty. I mean, now my layperson's knowledge or lack of thereof is showing. So
Well, yeah, as Eric pointed out before, it's not exactly empty space, but it is a long trip back.
Yeah.
And it takes a while to send the data back because they're not sending it at the highest rates possible, but they are sending it back at a steady rate, and so it takes a long time. And downloads from deep space spacecraft take notoriously long periods of time to get the information back. And we saw a hint of this with New Horizons, which arrived at Pluto last summer. And the data, you would say in a way that the data is coming back at a trickle, but the detail that's coming down is really, really good. And the same is going to be true for this spacecraft, is that it may take longer than people would expect it to take, but the information that's coming back is very dense and highly packed and lots of good stuff in it.
Mm. Any glitches so far?
Not that I know of. I think it won't. It'll be as Randy had said before. It has just slipped into orbit around Jupiter, but still kind of slingshotted around. It's in a very elliptical, elongated orbit where it passed very close last night, and now it's more slowly doing the longer part of that loop, and it'll gradually move into a little closer orbit before it starts to collect more data and then starts to send it back.
All right, we've got some calls coming in to 888-477-9499. Dave from Clinton, New Jersey, welcome to Radio Times.
Hi, thank you. This is a great opportunity, and right after it happened, I'm impressed. You get these guys on the air. My question has to do with the magnetic field, the origin of it, because, I mean, normally in planets like Earth, we have a ferromagnetic core, and so it's pretty clear how the magnetic field gets generated. From what I've read about Jupiter's core, people think it's highly compressed hydrogen. It might even be magnetic. It might even be metallic, but could it be a similar source? It wouldn't be ferromagnetic, I guess. So that's kind of what my question is sort of technical about how physically you could generate a magnetic field like as huge as the one Jupiter has without having a rotating ferromagnetic chunk of material.
Hmm. Okay, thanks, Dave, for the call to Radio Times. Want to take a crack at that, Derek?
Well, I would say that the way it looks is that, or what's presented makes it seem as if there might be some sort of a ferromagnetic core, but we don't really know enough about the core of Jupiter yet to say exactly what it is, which is part of the point of why we're doing this, to get a better grip on what might be able to cause that. But as far as another mechanism, I can't think of one off the top of my head. Eric, do you have one?
Yeah, I think so you can take the analogy of a iron magnet. You talked about ferromagnetism, and you can apply that to some extent. But there's also something called the dynamo effect, which is basically something that can make a magnetic field stronger. So as long as Jupiter has something in its core that can conduct electricity, so if it has that hydrogen that's in that metallic phase that makes it a good transporter of electricity, then if when it formed, it trapped a little bit of the sun's magnetic field inside it, then that rotation can actually amplify that magnetic field. So if you have a little bit of starting magnetic field, even without what we think of as a metal core, as an iron core, you can spin that up. You can strengthen that magnetic field. So that may be part of what's going on with Jupiter. But as Derek said, we're going to learn a lot more about this over the next month, and that's part of the goal of the mission.
Sure. So how far above the surface of Jupiter is Juno at any one time in orbit? And I know the orbit changes, but at the closest Juno gets is approximately how many miles?
I think that the closest approach is expected to be about 3,100 miles.
Hmm.
And then the greatest distance is a little over 1,000,000 miles out. So it takes this big, long course so that it can spend as little time in the magnetic field and the high radiation fields as possible, but still yet be able to collect really good science, especially in the polar orbit. So it'll have these brief periods where it's really close and then these very extended periods where it's pretty far away. The whole orbit is about 14 days long, and there are 37 of them, so it's anticipated that they'll be able to collect quite a bit of information before the nasty environment degrades the electronics.
Yeah. So, and I don't know that you have the exact information about this, but again, we're talking about at the very least, several thousand miles above the surface. What instruments does a craft like Juno use to determine what the core of a giant planet like Jupiter consists of?
Yeah, so basically there's a couple things that we can learn about it. You're right that we can't see the core directly. We can't see light that goes all the way into the center because it's opaque. One of the things that Juno will be able to do is basically measure how uniform the density is of Jupiter or how centrally condensed that density is. It turns out that those two different things exert just very slightly different gravitational pull. So as Juno is zipping by Jupiter, depending on whether it has a really condensed core or is a little bit more spread out, that's going to change a little bit the gravitational pull it feels, and that's going to move the path of the spacecraft by just very small amounts as it goes along. And the engineers at NASA can measure those very tiny movements basically due to changes in the signal that Juno sends back. So it'll be continuously transmitting a signal back as it passes by Jupiter. And just in the same way that when you hear ambulance passing by and you can hear the pitch higher when it's coming towards you and lower when it's moving away from you, very small changes in Juno's speed will give you changes in the pitch, essentially, of the signal it sends back. And that'll give us some information about not exactly what the core is made of, but how dense a core versus how spread out the interior is.
Okay. And again, Jupiter is more like the sun than it is like Earth.
Yes, very much so in that it's mostly gas. So you have an enormous sphere of what's essentially mostly gas with some sort of a solid core in the center, unknown yet as to what it is, but primarily more gas than anything else.
All right. Derek Pitts is chief astronomer and director of the Fells Planetarium at the Franklin Institute. Eric Jensen is professor of astronomy at Swarthmore College. The subject is Juno, now orbiting Jupiter. And lines are open at 888-477-9499. You can tweet us as well at WHYY Radio Times. Stay with us. Radio Times continues in just a moment. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan in for Marty Moskowain, and this is Radio Times on WHYY in Philadelphia. Our guests this hour are Eric Jensen, professor of astronomy in the physics and astronomy department at Swarthmore College, and Derek Pitts is chief astronomer and director of the Fells Planetarium at the Franklin Institute. So again, we talked about the cost of this mission and the fact that it's expected to cost over $1 billion throughout the life of the Juno mission. So to those who say, all that money, what do we gain? Derek Pitts, what is your answer?
Well, my answer to this always revolves around how we prioritize what it is we do here in the U.S. If we look at NASA's overall budget of, I think it's somewhere around $18 billion for the next year coming up, when you look at NASA's place in the hierarchy of all the other line items in the U.S. budget, it comes in at 14th or 15th. It's very, very, very low down the list of things. You might be able to make an argument that $18 billion could be spent on something else that might be more beneficial. But when you look at the enormous sums that are spent on health and human services and other things, not to disparage those things, sure, then you get a real sense of how much is really being spent by NASA. And if you look at it another way, you can say one penny of every tax dollar is what goes into NASA's budget. So it's not a lot at all. However, what we get out of it is a tremendous benefit. Not only is there the tremendous amount of knowledge that comes out of it, but there's all sorts of other technological advancements and developments that come out of what it is that NASA does to create these spacecraft. Sometimes people like to argue that, well, we would have developed those things had we not done this also. And one could say, yes, that's true. But here we have a specific purpose for which these technologies are being developed, and now we can apply those technologies or their quote-unquote spin-offs to many other things. At the same time, the last thing it does is it inspires people to want to become interested in the STEM fields. And that's critically important. Not that NASA wants everybody to be an astronaut, sure, or an astronomer, but that it is critically important for this nation to have a strong STEM basis, because I think of it as one of the three legs of what this country stands on, is its technological capability. So we can't do without that, and we need engineers in the future. We need scientists. We need mathematicians in the future.
And, of course, at the Franklin Institute, it's all about kids.
Somebody's got to take my job at some time, yes.
You know what? I read that three Lego figurines are on board Juno in the likenesses of Galileo.
And one of them's not me, unfortunately.
Galileo, Jupiter, and Juno. And interestingly, they're not built of plastic, but of aluminum. And when I read this, there was no explanation. I don't know if you guys have any thoughts as to, it's kind of a fun fact anyway.
Juno, I don't know the answer. More durable,
yeah,
I guess.
Yeah, maybe
that's
the plastic
what I understood, too.
Yeah.
There was
yeah.
some concern about whether or not the plastic would be able to survive the trip. So
sure. Well, according to NASA, it's to inspire kids to explore science and technology and engineering and math.
And I'm sure Lego's very happy with that.
I'm sure they are. Okay, so let's get to some tweets and emails. Paul writes, what wattage are the transmitters that we use to send commands to Juno and that Juno uses to send info back to us? How many antennas are we using, and how do we separate the signal from the noise in an 800 million mile transmission? So that's a lot of information there, and I'm not sure we have it all. But Eric, I'll take the last bit of it because
I know the answer to it a little bit more easily, which is the signal versus noise is we know right where Juno is, and Juno knows right where Earth is, and so you can point. Juno can point its antenna back at Earth and transmit. So part of the reason it sent just these beeps last night instead of sort of any signal is that it had to be turned the wrong way around in order to fire its engines in the right way. But normally it'll point its antenna straight at Earth. NASA has an array of big radio telescopes that can point right at Juno. So the signal's very weak, but we know exactly what we're looking for. I imagine there's a little bit of extra information sent along with it as sort of error-correcting extra information. As far as number of transmitters and wattage, I'm not sure about that.
Well, we can give some sort of a sense of this. You know, some amateur radio operators, ham radio operators, have transmitting equipment that will transmit signals at 1 kilowatt, 1,000 watts. The spacecraft itself only uses 500 watts altogether. So the signal that's being transmitted, the signals that are being transmitted back and forth, as Eric said, are very, very low power. But we have these big dishes. And one of the other interesting issues that comes along with this, and when you talk about radio noise, is sometimes there can be inherent radio noise in the equipment itself. And you have to sometimes be able to dig the signal that you want out of that inherent noise. So one thing that's done is that the receiving equipment is cooled, chilled to very, very low temperatures, sometimes well below zero, several hundred degrees below zero, so that you can damp down all of the radio noise of just the equipment itself so that you can pull the real signal that you want out of the background of that.
If something does go wrong with Juno, how difficult is it to try to tweak that from a distance of close to 2 billion miles, Eric Jensen?
I imagine it's very difficult. One of the things that makes it difficult that we talked about before is this 40-minute one-way travel time. So if you wanted to try to, if your car was a little off course and you wanted to try to re-correct it, you could turn the wheel and then wait 40 minutes for something to happen and then wait another 40 minutes to see how it worked out, and that'd be hard. That said, I know that NASA has a lot of contingency plans for various things. And one of the nice bits from last night's news was one of the people holding up his communications contingency plan and saying that they could throw it out now because they didn't need it now that Juno has made the orbit insertion. But they do have various things built into the spacecraft for it to, for example, go into a low power mode if it senses that something's wrong so it doesn't use up all its power, and various sequences of things that they can do to try to recover from these and get back.
And we have a question from Pat, who's in Camden. Pat asks, in the off chance that they do find life on Jupiter, would they release that information right away or sit on it for a while? We don't know. Probably, I would guess, if it were me, maybe just look at it to actually confirm that you're seeing what you think you're seeing.
I would say that there is a tremendous amount. Somewhere there's a contingency plan for this. But First of all, understanding what the possibilities and probabilities are, you know, all that stuff being very low, if something may be found, I would imagine that there would be a tremendous amount of testing and vetting over and over and over again,
sure,
to make sure that what's being seen is really what is being suggested it is.
Yeah.
Whether or not it would be released, I think it's incredibly difficult for us to sit on any kind of secret for any long period of time. Benjamin Franklin said, three can keep a secret if two of them are dead. So I don't know how long a secret like that might last.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I think the biggest challenge would be knowing what you're seeing and being sure that you know. You know, how would we, you know, we're not going to find people there. We're not going to find animals there. And so if it was some kind of life, it would be incredibly different from anything we've seen before. Mm. And so being able to be sure enough that what you're seeing is life would be the biggest challenge. But once you were sure or even had any kind of strong suspicion, then you would want to tell people right away so that we could try to verify it.
And yet earlier in the program, we were talking about the fact that when Juno's mission is over, Juno is just going to die on Jupiter and not so as to not possibly contaminate Europa. Was that it? Which would be the satellite that would have the most, the biggest chance of bearing?
Right. That's exactly right. So there's discussion and talk and nothing specific, I don't think, planned right now, but of possibly one day sending a mission to Europa, which is one of Jupiter's moons that looks like it probably has an ocean below the icy surface that we see. And so liquid water is one of the things that people talk about as a hospitable environment for life. And so if there is life elsewhere in the solar system, that would be a good candidate. And one of the things we would want to be sure to do is not mess that up. We know from all the way back to the Apollo missions that bacteria lived on the outside of the lunar lander and went all the way to the moon and came back and were still alive. And so there are incredibly hardy species of Earth life that could be transmitted from Earth. And we want to be sure not to contaminate any future investigations of what other life might be in the solar system by introducing something from Earth and then muddying the waters about what we'd be seeing if we saw something later.
What would the temperature be like on Europa?
Oh, my gosh. The temperature on Europa, it's probably, what, 250 below zero Fahrenheit?
Yeah, it's super cold. The surface is super cold. The reason there can be liquid water there, so to get liquid water, you have to get above 32 degrees Fahrenheit.
Yeah, sure.
It's Jupiter's incredibly strong gravitational pull that is constantly stretching and kneading and pulling on Europa. Even though it's a solid planet, it can stretch it and squeeze it, and that, just like squeezing a ball of putty in your hands, eventually warms it up, and that's what keeps the oceans below the surface liquid, we think, on Europa.
And you can even see some of the effects of what's happening underneath when you look at the surface of Europa. Some of the ripple effects or cracks and fissures that you see on the surface are the result of these big blocks of ice being moved around on the surface by the currents underneath.
Stay tuned. All right.
There's more there.
Back to the phones. Randy in Levittown. Welcome to Radio Times.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I'm just curious, are any of the scientists taking bets on how big the core actually is? I'm thinking if you have all that gas collected in one spot, there must be something massive in the center. I mean, do they have any theories on how big it may be? Or
any wagers going?
I don't know about wagers. Certainly different people have different ideas. I personally, I'd be incredibly surprised if we don't find out that there's a core there. So there are a couple of theories of planet formation, and to be brief, basically one of them involves gradually building up a rocky and icy core from gradual accumulation of small things like we see in the asteroid belt today, and then later adding on this layer of gas on the top. Another theory is that an instability in the gas orbiting the sun very early on could more quickly form a planet that is smoother and more homogeneous. But we have a lot of evidence that that first model is well-supported and consistent with a lot of observations we have. We're not 100% sure, but I'll be very surprised if we don't find a substantial core in Jupiter.
Eric Jensen, just want to make one mention before we wrap the show up here. It was announced you were part of the discovery of a planet approximately, what is it, 3,700 light years away? Can you tell us about that briefly?
Yeah, recently NASA, this is a collaboration with a bunch of other scientists, as many scientific discoveries are these days. And so NASA had another mission
called Kepler that has been surveying for planets around other stars, and that has discovered thousands of planets. But part of this discovery that you mentioned is we found a planet that's orbiting not one sun, but two suns. So just like in that iconic scene from the movie Star Wars that I saw when I was 10 years old, and Luke Skywalker looking out at those two suns rising over Tatooine, we found this planet, which is one of a handful of planets like this that have been discovered, that's orbiting around this pair of stars. And so this is a planet that would have a double sunrise every day that it orbited.
And also looking ahead, there are some new space telescopes on the horizon. What will they offer, Derek Pitts? That's something I'm hearing about, the James Webb Space Telescope.
James Webb Space Telescope is going to be not a visual telescope, but an infrared telescope. So it's looking for heat signatures out in the very deep universe, trying to find some evidence to put together more pieces of the puzzle of the origin of the universe, and maybe do a little bit of exoplanet work as well, looking at forming solar systems elsewhere in the universe. But James Webb will be situated at a location far enough away from Earth that it won't be serviceable like Hubble Space Telescope was. So that means James Webb will have to work reliably from the first start out, and it's due to launch in 2018.
So, but back to the present, we've got Juno now in orbit around Jupiter. And what is next in the immediate, the next 24 hours? What are scientists looking for? Anything specific, or just waiting to see that everything's getting back to Earth okay?
Well, the first thing they're going to do is turn all the instruments back on. They shut most of the science instruments down back at the end of June for this maneuver to come into orbit around, so that they could make sure that there would be as little damage done to any of those instruments as possible before the science began. So they'll be turning those instruments on over the next several days. And as Eric mentioned earlier, they'll be shaping the orbit a little bit more over the next 2 months or 2.5 months, 3 months or so. And then by October, they'll really get into using the science experiments once they get the orbit down from a 53-day orbit down to a 14-day orbit. So that'll happen over the next few days, and they'll continue to check out the equipment and make sure everything's working.
So come October, we might get some real new understanding of what's happening as far as the nature of Jupiter.
I think that's right. And I think it's going to be realistically, I think we'll start to get some cool pictures back, some preliminary results. One of the ways that Juno will accumulate information is via these repeated passes by the planet and seeing things that are just slightly different on each pass and being able to do that. So some of the, for example, measuring the size of the core, I think is going to take a little bit longer to do that. So I think we'll get some kinds of results, maybe composition of the clouds, maybe amount of water in Jupiter's atmosphere a little more quickly, and then some of the more structural things may take a little bit longer.
And perhaps the way that we could frame it is, again, like New Horizons was done. It was great to get that spacecraft out to Pluto and to have it get right on target, exactly where it needed to be for the flyby. But one of the things that NASA repeatedly said about that was, even though the spacecraft has arrived, it's going to be quite a while before we actually start to get real science data back. But let's show you a little bit of what we have now. Stay tuned. We have a lot more to tell you as the data comes back to us. And that'll be the same thing with this. As the information comes in, researchers like Eric and others will get to pour through it and figure out what they want to figure out about it and put it together and then make it available to the public.
All right. On that note, we have to wrap it up. Derek Pitts, a pleasure as always. Derek Pitts is chief astronomer and director of the Fells Planetarium at the Franklin Institute. And Eric Jensen, our thanks to you as well.
Thank you. It was great to be here.
Eric is a professor of astronomy in the physics and astronomy department at Swarthmore College. And as always, we invite you to visit our Facebook page, and you can take a look by heading to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you'll also find our podcasts there as well. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan in for Marty Moscawain on Radio Times.